This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.
Hello, you're listening to Glenn Pugh for AvWeb.com. On December 4, 2010, a Piper jet prop P-46T was flying at 26,000 feet over the Gulf of Mexico behind a Pratt & Whitney PT-6A-35, one of the most reliable turbines in the world. Roughly an hour from land, the aircraft began to lose power, and it soon became clear it would not reach the coast. There were four men aboard when the aircraft went into the water. All survived uninjured. We're talking today with Kelly McHugh. Kelly was left seat for the flight. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Glenn.
Now, first of all, let's set the stage. While you were flying left seat, you had an experienced pilot with even more time and type, actually, in the right seat and two other men in back. Introduce us to those men and give us their roles as the flight began. We'll get into how those roles might have changed a little bit later.
Sure. The right seat was Ken Ross, who's an airplane partner with me in the plane and also a experienced 8,500-hour jet pilot with the airport. He's retired, but he's flown Phantom 4s and, F-15, so he's a highly experienced pilot. In back were two passengers. We were on an excursion to look at real estate in Honduras. We had made a stop for fuel in Cozumel. We probably could have made Honduras, but we certainly wanted a lot of reserves. So going down and coming up, we stopped in Cozumel and refueled. So we had left Cozumel about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We're very careful about fuel in Mexico. One of us always stays by the plane to watch what they do, which I did. Ken took care of the customs. And then we took off. We flew. Plane came out of the annual a week or two ago. We had no trouble for 3 hours going down and an hour and a half coming back up. But right dead over the middle of the Gulf at 26,000 feet, the engine made a distinct change in pitch.
Let me stop you here before we go. It's important that we point out this is a Piper jet prop. This is a conversion, correct?
That's right. We bought this plane about, I'd say, 6 or 8 years ago when it was a Malibu and it had a piston engine and it was not very reliable. About 5 years ago, this plane went to Spokane, Washington to rocket engineering where the whole plane was rebuilt and the Pratt & Whitney PT-6 was put on it. A very expensive conversion, way more than the cost of the original airplane, but it gave us a sense of reliability with the PT-6 that we've made numerous overwater trips in this plane to the Bahamas and Mexico, and I've never had any problems with it, and, just loved it, made it an ideal plane.
On this particular flight, what did you do for flight planning? How was the weather? Who were you in contact with on the radio? What was your plan ahead of time? And did you plan for any sort of possibility? Do you go over any of these possibilities in advance?
Sure. First off, flight planning, can't handle most of the weather flight planning. The weather was very benign. It was clear skies, light winds, no real problems with the weather. I mean, it was just a beautiful day to fly. We there were three pilots in the group that are experienced, and not only do we do yearly training, but we do our own practice sessions. So we have an overwater bag we carry, and we have an overland bag we carry for emergencies. On overwater, we always carry a raft, and the overwater bag that gives us a spare GPS, a spare EPIRB, and a spare communications radio. So we do think about those things. There's a few places that the plane can't glide to. This plane with a big, wide wingspan can glide for 45 minutes and 90 miles. So a lot of times over the Gulf, there's only a few dead spots, so to speak, that this would happen. And unfortunately, when the engine developed these problems, we went in one of those spots.
So on this particular trip, you'd taken off out of where, and you were headed for
We have taken off from Cozumel, Mexico, heading almost due north, 345 degrees, going into New Orleans. Our ultimate destination was Hammond, Louisiana, right north of New Orleans, but we had to go to New Orleans to clear customs. So we were heading for New Orleans International Airport.
All right, so
we were 175 miles from the airport, about 100 miles from the coast of Louisiana.
Well, put us in the cockpit with you as things started to go wrong here. What did you see? What did you hear? What were you thinking?
Sure. First, we were flying along that dumb and happy at 26,000 feet. There was a noticeable difference in the engine, the pain change of the sound, the pitch. And Ken and I just both perked up, and Ken looked at me and said, "What did you do?" And I said, "Nothing. We didn't touch anything." So just right, it stopped. Shortly thereafter, we started noting a very erratic torque. And that's when Kim and I both said, "This, we've never had this situation before." At 25,000 feet, Ken, who was right seat, we fly a lot together, so the guy on the right seat usually does the communications and the navigation, and the left seat does the piloting. So Ken did, almost immediately declared an emergency within losing, 2,000 feet of altitude. We were talking to Houston Center, so they knew all the way. We've had some other instances where we thought we had a problem with other airplanes, and we don't declare an emergency until we really feel that way, just because of the paperwork and, the souls on board. But we declared emergency very early.
Well, you were losing airspeed? You were losing altitude? Is that what was going on?
Yes. The engine was decaying in power. We started losing altitude. We took it off autopilot because we didn't want to have to contend with the plane stalling. So we started losing altitude. We had not feathered the prop. We immediately felt it was a fuel problem just in our heads because there's not much that can go wrong with this PT-6. You got fuel, you don't even need the igniters once the fire is in the can. So we started, Ken started immediately, mental checklist of changing tanks. We have like 7 different fuel pumps on the plane, changing fuel pumps, going through the emergency fuel pump, switching tanks, checking for the emergency shutoff valve to look at those situations.
What were you thinking while all that was going on? You're flying the plane, he's running checklists?
Well, immediately, Ken and I designate, we were heading straight to New Orleans. As soon as we realized we had a problem, we were heading at 345 degrees. We turned the plane to straight north, which would have been our closest land, which was the tip of Louisiana by Venice. And then Ken started the emergency checklist on fuel starvation. Then he noticed that it wasn't. We were actually, throwing fuel overboard. At about 20,000 feet, we made a decision. He said, we need to go ahead and feather this prop because our glide at that, going from 26,000 feet, we were dropping about 1,500 feet a minute. If you feather the prop on this PT, on this jet prop, you can knock that down to about 600 feet a minute.
What?
If you fly at the right airspeed. So we had to slow that plane down to 90, and so we wanted to retard to give us the most glide distance we could.
When you did that, were you aware of what your range would be with the prop feathered?
Right, we're absolutely right off the bat. We weren't going to make it, yeah, because we knew what the range was. We knew we weren't going to get close because we dropped the altitude because we didn't want to feather the prop because we thought we were going to get that thing restarted, and also some emergencies where you can restart with the prop. So not only charted with the fuel, then we went to the checklist and Ken performed the emergency procedures while I hand flew the plane. We started doing different restarts. We had plenty of battery, we had plenty of spark, and we actually had fuel going into the engine. So we just, after 3 or 4 starts, we were pretty calm. I was flying the plane, so, it was pretty intense, and also kind of helped Ken because they kept wanting position coordinates. You have to read out a lot to do that every 1,000 feet, which wasn't going to happen. But we were giving them kind of rapidly. But so Ken was continuing to go through the checklist, numerous different restarts. And then we had so much time. We were up in the air for, well over 30 minutes. Ken thinks it's close to 40 minutes where we were in the air gliding down.
Now,
and he just sat back and said, what could we have forgotten or what could we have changed? I mean, we had plenty of time to try and diagnose the problem. But there was nothing to do. I mean, we burned the batteries up trying to restart the plane.
Well, now, as the man responsible for keeping the aircraft flying, what happened in your mind?
I was not really too concerned because I knew that the weather was good and the seas were good. Coast Guard was notified, and actually we found out later that they had launched a helicopter from Venice or Belchase and were heading out to us and were in the air for 30 minutes while we were still coming down. They were coming out to get us. So I wasn't overly concerned, and I wasn't really petrified. We had flown that plane when we had trained in this plane, and we had first checked the plane out. The maker of it even takes you to altitude and pulls the engine where you lose the engine. So we knew what it felt like, and we weren't too nervous. Flying together, when you have somebody that knows what he's doing, and we're doing it logical. You're doing what you have to do.
And
it was not like it was a frightening situation, although we knew, we probably weren't going to make it, so let's get prepared.
And speaking of getting prepared, are you already thinking at, you know, I don't know, 18,000 feet? Is it already going through your head, you know, how you want to align the aircraft with the swells, yeah, that sort of thing?
Exactly. We were looking for the seas, which were not, you know, luckily the seas weren't about 2 or 3 feet, so that was very good. I started talking to two guys in back, and one of the guys in back was responding because I was giving them instructions out of my flight bag that was in back to go ahead and get the radios and put them in the waterproof bag and get, you know, look at the raft and get ready for the raft instructions to get the water bag out and get one of each one of our life preservers and let's get those on. He was just great in back. In fact, when we were heading straight north, he was the one that spotted a rig off to the right. And about, I don't know, 50 miles out, we were heading for the rig for 20 minutes. We altered course from straight north to like the 045 to head to a rig. This rig was out in the middle of nowhere because it's way farther than you normally see rigs off of Louisiana.
By rig, you just mean an oil rig out there, right?
Yeah, an oil rig. That's right.
Was there any way for you to tell if it was manned or not?
I knew it was manned because it's a deep water rig. It's not a platform. So that's a thing that's floating on the water, and it's 200 or 300 people on these things. They're billion-dollar facilities. Anything out that deep is manned. It would either be a drill ship or a semi-submersible like this one was. So, yes, I knew it was manned.
And was there any way for anyone to relay information to that rig?
Well, I don't know if they did or not. We were talking to air traffic control out of Houston. We got below a certain altitude. We could no longer... Houston couldn't read us, so we were talking to, I believe it was a United pilot above us. Now, of course, they had already notified the Coast Guard. I don't know that they had notified the rig, and I don't think they did, because actually that rig was not even supposed to be there. After we landed and the guys rescued us from the rig, they said, well, we were supposed to have moved 2 days ago. We're not drilling because of the moratorium. We're sitting out here exercising our equipment.
Well, now let's keep in the air here. As you're approaching it, how good is your approach? Do you have the altitude to make that rig? Are you going to be near it?
We were not sure until we were about 10 miles out. The whole time we kept stretching the glide, getting it down, keeping it at 90 knots, hand flying it, because at 90 knots, that's your best glide. And we really got to about 600 feet a minute. At about 10 miles out, you know, we all breathed a sigh of relief. We're going to make the rig.
Did you do any preparation for the actual impact? Did you talk about protecting your face? Did you talk about any of that stuff?
Well, we talked about putting the shoulder harnesses on. Greg was busy trying to get everybody's shoulder harnesses together and bracing for the impact. But we got over the rig at 2,000 feet. So I felt that's 1,000 feet to spare. About maybe 5 miles at the glide. So we circled the rig at one time, set it up in a base to try and land perpendicular to the waves. Coming in on turning to base, Ken says, I'll take the controls. He's a little more, you know, a lot more experienced pilot than I am. I said, that's good. It makes me feel even better. Well, when we went down, when we got into what wasn't ground effect, but what was over the water effect, Ken said, make sure, let's not drag the tail. We've got to land this thing on the belly. We don't want to land it like we do it, you know, on a runway where you get the back two wheels. We didn't want the tail to dig in and cartwheel. So it seemed like forever that we were floating on top of the water, just looking out at the sides of the waves. I'm bracing myself from the bulkhead, and all of us have the shoulder harnesses on. But we actually both, I'm seaplane rated, Ken's not, so I've done enough water landings to know what it feels like when you're looking out to the side and looking at the water, and you really, when you land a seaplane, you just want to bleed his energy off and let it lay in there too. So we both were at controls when it hit. We hit two or three waves, which at the only time that I was concerned with, this was going to be like a car, you know, an auto accident. So we hit two or three waves, pretty severe, and then the wing clipped on one wave, spun the plane 180 degrees at a dead stop, in a nanosecond. I shielded my face because I thought the windshield would break. The plane settled in the water completely upright with no damage. We were looking up at blue sky, and actually we were looking back at the rig. So, you know, we had made it.
What sort of forces did you feel on the impact? I mean, was it side loads? Was it straight ahead loads? Was it both?
It was straight ahead loads, yeah. Ahead loads.
And how would you compare it? Did it feel
I haven't been in an automobile accident. One of the guys said it felt like I'd hit by a baseball back and bat. I can tell you that my shoulder harness bruised my shoulder. But so it was pretty severe. It would be like an automobile accident. I think we hit that water, we were about 75 knots. So I guess if you were in an automobile accident at 30 or 40 miles an hour, that's what it would be like.
And so you're in the water now. Did you take inventory? Were you taking inventory? Are all my arms and legs still attached? Is anybody bleeding?
Well, as soon as you looked up and the windshield wasn't broken and everybody was fine, we looked around, it was time to, okay, let's go to the emergency hatch, which is right behind the co-pilot seat. And the guys, we weren't reaching it. The guys in the back tried the emergency hatch, and they couldn't get it. So immediately said, just go to the door and open the top of the clamshell, which we did because there was the plane wasn't racked. So the door opened. The top of the clamshell opened really easily. The first guy exited with the raft rather quickly. Ken and I took our times. We actually stood out on the wing and, you know, adjusted our Mae West-type vest before we even got into the raft. So Ken stood on the wing for a number of minutes. The plane took about, I'd say, 15 minutes to finally sink. But for over 5 minutes, it was sitting just level in the water, slowly, you know, getting water into it. So we all got into the raft, looking at the rig. There were no supply vessels around the rig. Normally you see some supply vessels. So we didn't see anybody that looked like they noticed us.
About how far off were you at that point?
We're about a mile and a half. We glided on the water for a good time. So we paddled over because when one guy did the raft, the other guy let go of the water bag that had the communications, emergency communications, and we even carried a second EPIRB. So we paddled over about 10 yards and picked that up. And when I looked at the rig and didn't see anyone, I said, guys, let's just start paddling towards the rig because the current and the wind were taking us away from it. And we didn't know what was going to happen. And it wasn't, you know, 3 minutes later that I saw the rig, a boat come down from the side of the rig and saw the white waves and knew they were coming to get us. So we weren't in the raft for, you know, 10 or 15 minutes before an experienced rescue boat from the rig, and these guys, all with workers, but they're the ones that are trained for the rescue, came and plucked us out of the raft, picked up the raft, and medical equipment, even on that emergency boat, and really had us back at the rig in, I'd say, 15 minutes.
What was the first thing you did once you were on the rig?
We thanked them. One of the guys came off and says it was a rush. About 3 o'clock, I had called my wife and said we were going to be late for a party and we're going to make it home. Two or three of us had called our wives at about 3 o'clock, and the emergency started at 2. And we were, you know, probably 2:40 when we hit the water. So within 20 minutes, we were high and dry on the rig. The water was, you know, beautiful blue, and it was not cold. And one of the guys was shivering. The other three guys were just excited to be, you know, that we made it. And the one guy in back that was doing all the work said, you know, no time did he ever think we weren't going to make it. He'd flown a lot with Ken and I, and he was a guy that was, you know, really taking care of the stuff in the back.
Well, in the aftermath, what happens now? What happens to the airplane? Is the insurer going to go in there after it?
No, they at first they weren't sure. But they're not going to recover the plane. I think one of my partners said we may have even already gotten a check for the hull insurance, which sort of makes us whole on the aircraft. I think the recovery would cost them more than, you know, what it would cost to pay the claim off. After that, because we went over it and over it and went actually met with the mechanic and got all the log books and all like this and started talking to the PT6 mechanic that knows the plane and talked to other mechanics. And we can't verify what happened, but there's something about this one high-speed, high-pressure fuel nozzle that's internal to the engine. It's not part of the checklist and only is checked at, you know, at the major, not even at the annuals, but every 4,000 hours. He thought that was the only thing that could have failed, where that you were spewing fuel into the engine, but it wasn't atomized enough to ignite. Now, that's just a supposition. We're not sure. Well, I don't think anybody will ever know because I don't think the plane will be recoverable.
Well, we've been speaking with Kelly McHugh, a man who put his airplane down in the Gulf of Mexico and lived to talk about it with all of his companions. I'm Glenn Pugh for AvWeb.com. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine. For more on aviation safety, log on to www.aviationsafetymagazine.com.